All my relations come, every nation come, all my relations under the sun, we are one.
Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. Today it's Saturday, February 17th, 2018, and I am super excited to introduce, I have two guests on the line from Big Blend Radio, Lisa and Nancy, and they're here to talk to us about gardens and national parks and just all sorts of cool things. I know you're going to love it. So welcome to the show, Lisa and Nancy.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm awesome. How are you ladies today?
We're doing good. We're very happy because here in Tucson, we've just had two full days of nonstop rain, nice, consistent, pitter-patter, like heavy rain, but not like, you know, crazy heavy, but really good rain, which means we most likely will start to see wildflowers in the next week.
Holy cow. Well, I'm here in Montana, and we're like having blizzard today. Our ground is totally covered in snow, so we won't be doing any of that soon. But I know my listeners are all around the world and lots in California and Florida, so they probably have similar situations to where you are. Now, do you want to tell listeners? You're in Arizona, right?
Yeah, we are in Arizona, but we do a lot of travel, and we appreciate being on your show, the Organic Gardener Podcast. I think it's exciting, kind of the tie-in that we do cover a lot of gardening on our Big Blend Radio shows, but also we're based in Tucson, but it's kind of a place to eat, sleep, and work, and then get back on the road because we're on a quest to visit and cover all 417 national park units. So it's like national monuments, seashores, trails, as well as the big national parks like what you have in your backyard, Jackie, but also covering the gateway communities and the smaller parks and public lands around the parks as well. So that's what we're doing. So yeah, we're home in Tucson, but then we're about to hit the road again.
Awesome. Well, I'm so excited to talk because you were telling me about that there's a lot of gardens and parks that I hadn't heard about. So I know listeners are going to be excited. But do you want to tell us a little bit about yourselves and your background? Like your mother and daughter, right? It's Nancy Reed, right? And you're Lisa Smith, right? And Nancy's the mother.
She's the mom. She's the boss lady.
That's right. Don't you forget it.
Yeah. Well, we could probably just in a nutshell, our background is we're from Los Angeles area originally, and that's where Nancy gave birth to me and then right after that gave birth to an organic garden with goats.
That's because Lisa is allergic to just about everything ever invented.
And
nothing was working very well. So it was time to get goats because she could have goat milk, but not cow milk, and organic veggies and hardly any grains at all. So that's how I got into organic gardening.
Mm. How interesting. All right. Well, I always kind of do start out the show asking about like your very first gardening experience. Like Nancy, do you want to start and tell us like, were you a kid? Were you an adult? Was that it when you had Lisa, the first garden you have? Or like, and if you were a kid, like what'd you grow? Who were you with? Like what was your very first gardening experience? Are you from LA too?
Yes. And I think my first experience would be with my grandmother who had what she called a victory garden. And mm-hmm. I only remember her living in one house for forever. And she had a garden at the back. And that's as soon as we visited her, that's where we ended up in the garden. And she taught me a lot about gardening. She was naturally an organic gardener. She never used any sprays or anything like that. She used beer to kill insects.
Like slugs and stuff? I remember my parents putting beer out for stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, that's how it was. And that seemed to work. And then she'd spray it on insects too. And sometimes spray it in her mouth.
Interesting. Oh, how do you spray beer in an insect's mouth? Like just because?
No, in her mouth.
She likes beer. She was little Nana, little tiny Nana loved her beer.
Yeah, she did.
That's so cute. Okay, and then how about you, Lisa? What was it like, you, I guess maybe similar growing up with your mom?
A little different. So when I was born, about a year and a half old, Nancy worked for Joy Adamson. I don't know if you've heard of the movie Elsa the Lion Born Free.
Yes, of course.
So Nancy went to work for Joy in Kenya. So the two of us went across across the ocean and out to Africa and lived out in the boonies for a while. And I would say that would kind of be my first gardening experience, was living with a couple different tribes, learning how to herd cattle and how they were growing things. But then after we lived in the bush for a while, because Joy Adamson got murdered, we moved into a neighborhood called Karen, which is named after Karen Blixen. People know her from the Out of Africa movie. But we lived in her backyard, actually, pretty much, in Kenya, in Nairobi, and had a garden there. And that's where I started hanging out in the garden and playing in the garden, and started there. And it just evolved and evolved from there as a young girl, just always out in the garden.
Yeah.
I have a big fascination with plants and their history.
That is so amazing. You know, actually, one of my very first interviews was with this friend of mine who lives here in Montana, up way on top of a mountaintop. And she actually went to Africa to work with the people who did, which I guess it would have been Joy Addison and her husband before they split up, I think. Is that how it worked? Anyway, but she never did go work with them, but that's how, that was like her first gardening experience, was there in Africa. I just replayed her episode the other day. That's so funny that you bring that up. How fascinating.
What's her name?
Well, her name now is Eve Clowers, but I don't know what her maiden name was back then. But she never did work for them, I don't think. She ended up getting a job as a typist for the United Nations.
Oh.
And working for the United Nations somehow over there. I want to say the Environmental Fund or something. And just, she had an amazing life. So, yeah, it's such a small world, because
no
how many
kidding.
People do you meet that normally want to go work with the creators of the Born Free, you know, the lions over in Africa that actually make it to Africa? And sounds like you guys have had just amazing lives and just stories to tell. So we're not really going to talk about your garden this year, because you said that you've been traveling so much, you haven't had a garden for a while. So do you want to tell us about some of the places that you've been and what you've been doing, and about your show, and just, I don't know, I'll be quiet. You guys talk.
We'll talk amongst ourselves. We do have a little garden. There's no way we can't have plants. We always have to have plants. So we do have a few plants around in a little patio garden, and we have hummingbirds and little verdin birds that come hang out with us. So we also live on the edge of a riparian area, so we get to see the birds and see the wash when all the monsoon rains come out here. So we do get a little bit, but it's not like what we, you know, if we get into the garden, then like the travel thing, it's a balance. It's either or. But I'd say definitely traveling, going to different national parks. One thing, you know, we're really big about is the fact that people should garden. It's about reclaiming the soil and fixing the soil. So it's a beautification thing for communities. And it's also, so it's from people's gardens, their backyard gardens, community gardens. And then even the national parks themselves, which are gardens. I mean, look at Glacier National Park as one big, big mountain garden, you know. Here in Saguaro National Park, like I said, you know, we're about to have wildflowers. And so you'll see things like the saguaro cactus, one of the largest cactus in the world, have their blooms in May. And you'll see the whole cycle happen. So a lot of the parks, you get to see things like that. And some of them, you get to see the individual gardens. I think the very first park we went to on the tour, and we've been to a lot of parks before that too, was Cabrillo, Nancy, and that had a garden in there.
The lighthouse keeper's garden.
Mm-hmm.
It's back in the day when the lighthouse was working with a live-in lighthouse keeper. The man and his family were pretty much alone up there on the coast, and so he had his own garden to feed his family. Otherwise, it's quite a trek to go and get food or fresh vegetables. So it was a nice coastal garden there up on that little mountain, little hill. And then
wait,
we can
now
look
where
over
is this?
And see,
San Diego.
This is in San Diego.
Oh, okay.
So you're up on the, like, on a little craggy cliff there on the lighthouse, and you can look down at the beach. Kind of cool. And then your veggies are right there. Mm-hmm. I would live there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that was interesting to see because it was things they also, not only did they grow crops, they had artichokes, and yes. But they had comfrey and chamomile, but they also grew medicinal herbs because that was going to be how they, you know, healed themselves as well. So that's some of the things you see in these gardens, these heritage gardens. And then out near us, there's Tumacacri National Historical Park. And there's an old mission. And this is really where the Juan Bautista Dance, the National Historic Trail, comes through here. And it's an expedition that was led by Juan Bautista de Anza and Father Font from Mexico, and Juan Bautista, you know, from Spain. And they came through from Mexico, and they took 200 people on foot from Mexico all the way to San Francisco. And that's how San Francisco was founded, at the Presidio there. That was how that happened. This is all while our country was actually becoming a country in 1776. But their first place over the border into the Arizona Territory was Tumacacri. And the mission was there, and the Presidio was there in this place called Tubac. This is just, you know, between Tucson and the border of Mexico now. But it was really interesting because you had a crossroads of cultures coming in. You have the Native American tribes out here, the Tohono O'odham, and then you also have the Mexicans and the Spaniards, and then the Afro-Latinos coming in. And so this culmination of food and plants and crops came in. So this is how the tortilla was made. We learned about that, how tortillas, you know, come from this, the culmination of the Indian fry bread, and kind of like a tortilla came in from Spain and Mexico. But they also grew things like quince, and they have heritage orchards out there, not only native plants, but they have an orchard out there where you can see old roses, Castilian roses, and you can see quince and apples and things like that. So that's another kind of garden you'll see in the historical parks. Is really, they try to keep the ancient actual rootstock from way back when to see it now. It's amazing.
Yeah, this is before we ended up with genetically modified everything.
Genetically engineered and modified, yeah. So, yeah, that's another example.
This is awesome. I love hearing about this. And I am not usually a history buff in any way, shape, or form, but I can just picture like this total like middle school, young adult novel written about some girl who comes with these 200 people on foot from Mexico to San Francisco. Like this woman, Jana Fox, who's in my children's book and illustrators group, wrote a book about a girl. First, she comes from Boston to Montana to Yellowstone. That's called Faithful. That's like this historical novel set back, you know, in about the 1800s, same time period. And then it talks about somebody she meets in Yellowstone Park, like her life growing up in San Francisco during the big San Francisco fire. And I could just see her like writing this awesome story about some girl coming from Mexico to San Francisco back by foot in those days. It just sounds like, now that's interesting history to me. Like history when I was a kid was like, memorize all the dates of the different battles in the Gettysburg War. Like, oh my gosh, we just studied different battle after battle. So boring to me. This is much more interesting. And then how the tortilla came to be and just, you know, what a great
the
story
food,
about
it's,
food.
It's really interesting because when you go to these places, a lot of times they'll have ranger-led tours, and being a magazine and radio, we get to snag the rangers if we're lucky because, you know, but anyway, and get them on the side. But this trail is really, it's near and dear to my heart, and I drive everybody nuts because I don't stop talking about it. I think like my ancestors were on it or something, but 200 people went on foot through the desert. And at this point, we were Alta California, we were at that point, right, Nancy? And so we were still under Mexico rule as well. And coming through, no one died. One person died, it was during childbirth. And that was right at the very beginning of the trail. And no one died. Everyone was well kept and taken care for. But this is alive when you go into these places and step into gardens and things like that, you'll start to understand and feel what it was like to be there where these people actually did this amazing expedition. But the parks themselves all have demonstration gardens. Like you can go to the Tubac Presidio right next to this mission. And this is one of the oldest forts, in fact, the oldest state park in Arizona now. And they have a demonstration garden of, you know, native plants, but then also what the Mexican people cook with here. Then you go up a little bit and you'll go to a place called Picacho Peak and you'll see poppies in the spring. And, you know, so you just keep going and then to Yuma, Arizona, where the heritage area is, and you'll go to the banks of Colorado River where they crossed over. And this is a really amazing garden and restoration area. They have what's called the East and the Wetlands. The West Wetlands used to be an incredible eyesore. It was just this big landfill dump. And what the city did, and as part of this restoration effort and also part of becoming a heritage area, they restored the lower Colorado River where the East and Wet Wetlands are. And there's 49 agencies came together, different countries, Mexico, Arizona, California, and also the Tohono O'odham Nation came through, and the Kashans, right? Not the Tohono O'odham, excuse me, Kashans, worked together, and 49 agencies, I mean, you know how it is with agencies, they came together, restored this area, the wildlife have come back, they've restored it with all the native habitats, taken out the invasives, and where the landfill was, they built a park, they put a pond area where people can go fish, but they also turned it into a butterfly and a hummingbird garden, two separate gardens so people can walk. The bird life is incredible. It's all native plants. It teaches people about Arizona and desert plants. And I mean, there's birds everywhere. And that is all, and they have a solar garden for people to learn about. So it's taking this real eyesore and turning it into this amazing place. And on the East Wetlands, beaver came back, so you can see beaver in the river, all kinds of water birds, and it's also cleaned up the area for people as a, you know, place to go and recreate and have fun, where it used to be a lot of homeless people sleeping on the banks. And so now it's helped a community actually come back together and built their economy, which is really neat.
Yeah, it's a beautiful garden, and you could spend a whole day walking. Mm-hmm. You know, you can do the wildlife thing, the wild areas, and then you can go where there's ramadas and picnic tables. And I think, I also believe the playground there, their new playground, is the largest playground in Arizona.
Yeah, interactive playground for kids.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so it's amazing what a community can do and how much money it brings them now. The park is free, but a lot of tourism has been generated from having such a beautiful garden and a place for people to come and relax.
Especially a place that's kid friendly, because that's not always so easy to find. And it sounds like if it's interactive, it makes me think that there's like little places for the kids to learn things and to educate the kids while they're there about the native plants. And do you want to talk about that? I think that's a good segue into, because weren't you going to talk a little bit about native plants and how that can affect your landscape and like the landscape of a national park, how it's not just about your own backyard, but about the bigger ecosystem and community?
Yeah, actually it's interesting because native plants, you know, if you look at growing, like here we are outside Saguaro National Park. And if we grew everything ornamental, or I mean, at least do it organic, no matter what you do, right? So don't put pesticides in everything. It can affect the waterways that affect these protected wilderness areas. And the more you go into national parks and these preserved areas, you'll see how pristine they are. I mean, how everything is just abundant and life literally thrives. I mean, you'll look at a flower and you'll see just like 5 to 10 butterflies on one flower and bugs and spiders all in one flower. It's pretty amazing when you see that kind of, you know, thriving ecosystem. And when you grow native plants around your area, you're helping those wilderness areas be what they are, because bees are going to float over onto your plants and you don't want them taking your chemicals and then polluting the park. And also, you don't want invasives going into the park. And that's one of the biggest problems national parks are facing right now, is invasive species. And unfortunately, it's chemicals, and it's also from us bringing in these seeds from our walking around our gardeners as gardeners walking around our gardens or other parks and places that have these kinds of plants, we trek them into parks. Your tires can bring it in, and invasive species can go in there, or diseases. I know Pinnacles National Park, we were talking with a park ranger the other day on a show, and she was saying how, you know, we drag in fungus that actually, if we go into the caves and explore in the caves in this park without cleaning our shoes and things like that, we can bring in this fungus thing that can affect a certain bat species, and that can throw off a whole ecosystem. So we've learned a lot about that. I think Nancy, Oregon Pipe Cactus National Monument is in southern Arizona on the border of Mexico. And that community just literally blew our minds. It's a small historic community. It was a mining community and a railroad town. And then the mine pulled out, and everybody still thinks the mine may come in, but it's really not true. And this community was, you know, kind of left there and, you know, starving, but they have this beautiful national park with Oregon Pipe Cactus. It's the only place in America, our country, United States of America, you can see this Oregon Pipe Cactus. But that community, Nancy, was just mind blowing, and how they took
it's so pretty.
Native plants. And
one of the things I've noticed is we've lived in the States, both like in California, Arizona, Florida. We've lived in Mexico, lived in Kenya, we lived in South Africa. And in all those England, in all those countries, what I've learned about gardening is if you're a home gardener, you do not need all these insecticides, because you're not planting these huge rows and rows and rows of monocrops, which if you do that, you call in the one bug that loves that one plant the most. And now you have a problem because you don't plant how we used to plant. You know, these huge rows of one kind of plant, like Yuma is a good example. Yuma used to be a huge crop resource for peanuts. Now they can't plant them there at all because they had so many. The white fly came in and they couldn't get rid of the white fly, so they had to get rid of the peanuts. That's what happens when you do these monoculture farming ideas. But for the home gardener, if you have mostly native plants, and you don't do huge rows of the same kind of vegetable or same kind of flower or something, you mix it all up, you have a more natural setting, and you really don't get the pests. You will get some, but usually the birds take care of it. That's what I've seen in every single country that we've had a garden in, is as a home gardener, you really don't need anything lethal at all. You need birds and a little bit of beer.
Right. Yeah, here we go. But also, that's where this community, we were amazed when we walked in, that not only do they advocate for native plants, the entire town is a certified wildlife habitat through the National Wildlife Federation. The entire town. Everyone's garden is a certified wildlife habitat with native plants. They grow their own vegetables. They don't need a grocery store. They have community gardens. They have community farms. I mean, everyone works together to eat. It is insanely cool. And here they are right outside a national park. So you know that for that barrier isn't there. You know, there may be a park, you know, sign saying now you're entering the park, but for nature, it isn't there. So everybody's working together and living together. It's cool.
I love all of that. And do you want to maybe explain to listeners, because I do have a lot of new listeners because we just got picked up on Progressive Radio Network in August. Like, what exactly is a native plant? What makes that different? And then, like, should it be less intimidating, more intimidating to try to get native plants? Like, where do you come up with native? Because if you go to like your regular box store, even if you go to a local nursery, you might not quite be able to get some of those things. I mean, I talked to Dave Salmon down in New Mexico, and he definitely talked about how he went with native plants because when he started his nursery, he found that not only was it, he made more money because those were the ones that made his clients successful. Mm-hmm. And teaching his employees how to take care of the native plants and then spreading it on to the people who bought them, that's what made his business successful, because the native plants did better. They didn't need watering. Mm-hmm. They didn't require as much care. But do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I think native plants it takes a couple of years, just like any plant, to really you know, get its roots in the ground and get it all stabilized. But once it's like that, it will withstand, you know, a drought versus a non-native plant. If you go to the National Wildlife Federation website and type in Garden for Wildlife, it's up on blendradioandtv.com. We have it there. You just type in Garden for Wildlife. Once you're on their website, you can type in your zip code and you'll find the list of native plants. Box stores, I would really urge against using them. Mm-hmm. You can all send me emails and yell at me, but I really don't care. You go into a box store and you will lose money because there's certain cases where someone in the box store, the big box store, is into plants and will take care of those plants and knows plants because they garden. But often the case, it's not. We've lost thousands of dollars on box stores and thinking, oh, this is this kind of desert. Well, there's three or four different types of desert. And they'll just say this one cactus grows everywhere. Well, that's not true. Know your native plants. Your native plants are endemic. And that's why going into a park, something that is protected, whether it's a wildlife refuge, you know, a wilderness preserve, a national park, and seeing those plants, that's what you should be growing in your backyard. And so go find a native plant nursery, a native plant society. They will help you, someone local. I really encourage you to do that because, and you can get seeds too. Those are sometimes easier, but make sure it actually goes with your zip code. And because that's what the plants and the animals want, you know, the birds want that specific kind of plant. The other ornamentals, not so much because they come from another country. So finding native plant nurseries are key, and key to saving water, saving nutrients, and all of that kind of thing.
Wait, hold on a second. Sorry about that.
And there is a difference between a plant that gardening books will call naturalized, mm-hmm. which means it manages to grow in your area, but that is not necessarily a native. A native plant has always been in your area.
Yeah.
And so it settles in quicker. The one thing I would like to say that I think people sometimes get confused about native plants thinking that they do not need water. They do need water. They need to become established, which can take anywhere from 6 months to 2 years. And a lot of times people will bring home native plants and not water them, thinking, oh, I can just stick them in the ground and they'll be okay. And that just really isn't true. You need to give them water until they're established, and then you get to water them less. Problem being, when you buy them and plant them, is not always at the time when the weather cooperates. So you have to water until the plant grows its roots, spreads out a bit, and then can fend a little bit better by itself. So I think that's one thing people, if they don't have luck with native plants, it's usually because they haven't watered it long enough to make sure those roots get to grow. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an awesome point. And I think that's part of why, like, when I bought like wildflower seeds, they don't grow because I'm not preparing my beds right and I'm not watering enough. I think, oh, I'm just going to sprinkle those flowers out there and they're going to take off. And I either do it at the wrong time of year, like you said, when it's not moist enough, or I put them out when it's too cold, or like different things. And I can totally see that being the same situation with native plants. Those are excellent points. Before we get to the root of things, we're going to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. Today's episode is sponsored by the Awesome Science Action Club. You can join Mrs. Beyer and learn different science action, citizen science action projects or lessons or adventures to have at home that meet the Common Core and are going to be fun. So join Mrs. Beyer's Awesome Science Action Club by simply going to awesomescienceactionclub.com. Course.com. Mike and I have developed some lessons to help you create your very own organic oasis. We'll guide you through the steps to build your perfect natural landscape, an edible earth-friendly yard, a sustainable deep bed garden, or even start a small profitable market farm. We'll show you how to save time, lower your produce bill, collect usable data, eat healthy, nutritious food with minimal labor, use the most effective and efficient production methods currently being used in backyard gardens as well as market farms, and maybe even help you find some profitable markets. We've designed it to save you time, lower your produce bill, and help you eat healthy, nutritious food. There's checklists, there's outside reading, video assignments. You can join the online Facebook community where there's lots of people from around the world to help you get your garden started today. So remember, freegardencourse.com. Now let's get to the root of things.
Definitely go and look at some botanical gardens have like a native plant display, you know, or demonstration gardens. Try and look for those because they'll explain that and they'll have workshops and things like that. I know, again, the National Wildlife Federation, they have a list of gardens that you can go to in most major cities that you can, you know, go have a look and see what is growing in at least your state, you know, and start from there. But definitely look up native plant societies. They're doing awesome work, and the more we all connect with them and support each other, the better.
And then there's also certain insects and kinds of birds that you need in your garden to keep your garden healthy so that you don't need sprays. And one of the things that native plants does is bring in the right kind of insects and the right kind of birds to help you out. Mm. Whereas other plants, for example, you can buy a butterfly bush if you want butterflies in your garden. That is not native. And that will, yes, bring in butterflies to have a little bit of nectar, but it doesn't actually give them any place to lay eggs so that you actually get more butterflies. Yeah. And you need butterflies in the garden to help pollinate. So that's one thing. When you buy something that isn't native for your area, it might do one thing, but not another. So you're not really getting the benefit that you would if you had bought a native plant that will give both the nectar and provide a place for the good insects to live.
Oh, isn't that interesting that you need that just because they're getting nectar, they also need a special place to lay their eggs that they're going to hatch.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. There's a whole nother book right there. I love that.
Yeah. You've got to provide shelter, places for the young. Water is another big thing. That's another reason don't have chemicals, because like, hey, we've just had rain and it's really cool if birds can go and play in a puddle and it's not a puddle full of oil and chemicals and, you know, hey, drink that bird, you know, and then it dies. That sucks. I mean, and you see birds flying around with all kinds of bumps and weird diseases and things. And it's like, that just, we don't need to do that to our birds. And the more we plant of native plants, the less kind of seed and things we have to put out, because where does that seed come from? I always wonder what's in, you know, like really, we're worried about half of our grains and our crops right now with chemicals in them. What's in the bird seed?
Totally. That's part of why I want to grow bird seed. Like I want to grow sunflowers for bird seed, because we spend a fortune on that bird seed. But also, yeah, that's a really good point. Where is that bird seed coming from? What are they putting on that bird seed to get it? Where is it being sourced from? Those
are excellent points. Do you know where a lot of bird seed ends up going?
No.
I found out this the hard way. Ants. Mm-hmm. They take it and they take it underground and they burrow with it as a food source for them.
Yeah.
So when you find yourself having a lot of ants, you're probably putting bird seed out, because a lot of the bird seed ends up underground with the ants.
Mm-hmm. We have huge ant pile, like ant mounds or ant hills around our garden and all over our property. I never thought about that. But I know, like, I went to a workshop last spring and Patty Armbruster talked about one of the reasons you want to grow sunflowers around your garden is it does attract the ants and it keeps them away from your other vegetables. Mm-hmm. And then the sunflowers also bring in the beneficial insects. And it's kind of like this symbiotic relationship between the ants and the sunflowers and the insects that you really want to attract. And But like I said, it also kind of keeps them off of your other plants. Yeah, they didn't seem to hurt my sunflowers. My sunflowers almost all went to seed last year, and I did manage to save them from the birds, so I have seeds to plant this year. There was enough for both, it seemed like. Like, I planted, actually, I didn't hardly plant any sunflowers last year. Mike planted them all. Like, a couple of years, my first year of my podcast, my goal was to plant 750 sunflowers, and I thought that was a lot, but then I found out I need to plant, like, 750 sunflowers every week if I want to sell flowers for market. So, we'll see if that actually happens this year. I'm a little more excited. Starting, like, in April, the first week of April, and then going through till almost July, I should be able to put if I put sunflower seeds, I should have enough to take to market. Because the one thing I did find, those black oil seed sunflower seeds that I bought for the birds, they grew really well and they make really good flowers to harvest. Like, they're not so great at making the sunflower seeds that you want to. I mean, they did. They made enough, but they just, they were really, they had really pretty blooms. And I would get a lot of blooms on each stem, which was neat in some ways and not so neat in other ways. They kind of made it awkward in some of the bouquets. In other big bouquets, they were cool to have a couple. Like, two or three on a stem was good. If you had, like, five or six blooms on a stem, it seemed like those were awkward in a bouquet in a vase. Huh. I don't know if I'm getting off topic here, but yeah, that would be nice to have a lot of what?
Yeah. Do you have a lot of goldfinches? They love sunflowers.
We have a lot of grosbeaks and chickadees nuthatches. We get those giant green and gold grosbeaks every winter, and the tree, like, when they come through, the tree will be filled with, like, I don't know, a couple hundred of them. I mean, they are just, and then they go away. Like, they come during the winter this one time a year and then they're gone. They kind of come through our whole area. I mean, they do big bird counts around here. Sometimes we get those pine grosbeaks that have, like, the weirder, is that what they're called? Pine siskins, maybe? I don't know. They have, like, the weird crossbills. We get, I don't know, we get a lot of birds at my place. So, cool. And then the other thing I was going to say, like, Mike built this, like, his ideal situation is, like, so he built this, like, kind of creek thing and it goes into a pond and then eventually it's supposed to, like, the water's supposed to recycle up. But the thing about this pond, and, like, even though his is, like, I don't know, 20 feet long, you could build one that's only 2 feet long in your own backyard, just like a little water feature, and exactly what you're talking about. But the thing that worked the best, like, so we would just take our hose and put, like, an teeny tiny sprinkle coming out of it and it would go down, and it's like he, like, just kind of dug with a shovel, like, just not even 6 inches deep in a kind of a round thing, and then put plastic down and then rocks. But then the moss that grew on the rocks, the bees love to sit on that moss and drink.
Oh, cool.
And then there were all these itty bitty little teeny tiny puddles, you know, from the size of, like, your hand to maybe the size of my MacBook, you know, just these teeny tiny puddles that would form. And we got so many insects and so many, and especially the bees. When we had three hives at one point, they all have died at this point. So we're hoping maybe we're going to catch a swarm next year or something. I don't know. Mm. We've really struggled with bees at my place. But the one year that I think three different years we've got hives. Those bees love to sit on that moss. So, like you said, creating water features for and it was really, like, very simple for him to do. Like, anybody could really do that. Like, at first I thought, well, it's such a big thing. But then the other day I was thinking, you know, you could just make one that's the same principle, just a foot long, and it would make a nice water feature in any yard.
Water is key. Birds need some clean water sources, you know, and it all depends on where you live too. You know, some places, like, have tons of water and need it to then send it out to us in the desert. But yeah, and it's interesting too, you know, again, having the native plants, when you watch the cycles, you know, what may look like, you know, dead to us is not dead. Like, here, you know, during the dry times, you know, birds are picking open the old fruit from cactus and they'll get water from that. Like, we have javelina, which they're peccaries. They're, like, I call them pig warthogs of the desert. They go through and they'll eat cactus and people's trash, but they go through and you can just see, like, you take a big bite out of it and that's how they get their water. So it's just interesting when you have native plants, you'll see this whole cycle about everybody gets a little bit of what they need, sustenance. We get the beauty, and you can still have your garden as well. And if you want the pollinators for your vegetable garden, a really good thing is to have the native flowers, the native plants there too, because that will really bring in the right pollinators. That's cool.
You are so right
too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's good to mix your flowers in with your veggies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So
that really actually does a lot towards keeping out the bad insects.
Mm-hmm. All of a sudden you have the mountains with bear and mountain lions and bighorn sheep. So it's really amazing the difference. And then these grasslands where they're bringing the pronghorn back. And the story over there, just how a little bit of water, how these native plants, the grasslands coming back by burning the old out and bringing the natives back in. It's absolutely mind-blowing what we've learned going out there and hanging out with the park rangers, showing us, okay, here's the forbs and here's the alliums. And these are all plants that you can recognize as, you know, the ancestors of the plants that we grow for food. It's crazy. Like there's these alliums, they call them blue dicks here. And it's a relative of garlic and chives and onions. It's cool. And, you know, Native Americans used to eat them and, you know, probably still do. And so it's pretty interesting. If you look at Native American gardens, if you get that opportunity to see how they foraged and what they use from native plants, you'll learn so much of what we can grow. And it'll open up, you know, your palate to different plants and eating different things. But get information before you just start eating things.
Yeah.
Well, that just totally leads right into what I was going to say. I have an awesome source for that. One of my best friends, my listeners have heard me talk about her a lot, DC Adeli. She even did an episode with me about organic living. I'm pretty sure she's going to be coming out with her own podcast pretty soon here because she is really into wildcrafting. And even though she's like a Tlingit from Alaska, she's been in Montana since the late 90s for most of her adult life, and she's really learned a lot about how to use herbs. I mean, she's been selling soaps and things for your body for years, and just you walk into her house and it just like you feel rejuvenated because it smells so good. She makes all of her own natural cleaners, and she's been like, she's starting to create these boxes and of medicinal like herbs. She drinks herbal infusions she learned how to make from this other amazing podcast she keeps telling you about from Susan Weed. I don't know if you've heard of her. It's Susan Weed, like S-U-S-U-N Weed. But she knows so much about wildcrafting. So if you want to check out her blog, Simply Josephine, listeners, you can learn a ton. Her blog is amazing. She only puts it out once a month. I wish she'd put it out more, but definitely information about that. And then, so I told you I teach on the east side. I actually teach on a reservation with the Blackfeet Indians, and they're getting much more into sharing this with the students and with others. Like they came up with a thing this year where we all wear, on Thursdays, people wear like either ribbon skirts or ribbon shirts, or it's called Rock Your Moccasin, like trying to instill more culture. And now they have immersion classes. Kindergarten, first grade, second grade, like they're starting immersion classes in the schools. It's just the coolest. Like I feel so honored to get to be there and learn about their culture from them. I mean, they're like the kindest, funniest. They have the funniest sense of humor. And then I was telling like one of the new teachers last year, I'm like, you haven't seen anything till you've seen Valentine's Day in Browning. Like they're one of the most romantic people you've ever met too. Like they just totally get into it for like in the whole family sense. Like they love their kids. Like there was one year they had to like basically stop letting parents send flowers to the school because so many parents were like giving their kids flowers and candies and having them delivered in balloons. The classrooms were like, all right. But
wow,
it's just like a really cool thing. But they're definitely trying to bring back. I don't know if somebody wrote a grant or something, but things about the native plants and different things that they have used over the years over there.
It's important because, you know, they're storytellers, and it's their history has been, you know, passed on orally. And especially when, if we look at the terrible things we've done and, you know, and how people got split up and kids got, you know, their hair cut and moved here and done, you know, all of those stories, the truth, you know, and to reclaim their history and their heritage is really quite it's a hard thing, and it's an important. And from a lot of the Native Americans that we've talked to over the years, they're all kind of working together to reclaim their language, reclaim their traditions, and make sure that they're in place for future generations, because it's dwindling, you know. So it's important. I'm glad to hear that from up in your area.
Yeah, and like I said, it's just an honor to learn anything that they're willing to share or teach or do so. Well, so Do you have anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't mentioned today? I mean, I feel like you've both shared so many golden seeds. I know my listeners are going to really relate to this. You know, when they talk about niches and, you know, I was on this show called The Vegetable Gardener the other day, and I've kind of always kind of wondered about, like, what really is my niche? Because organic gardening is kind of a big topic. But I definitely think, like, creating earth-friendly landscapes is kind of our mm-hmm. niche on my show. Because, like, I call my audience green future growers, and just, it's more than just growing a garden. It's like creating an organic, earth-friendly environment. So
it's,
I feel like they're going to love
everything.
It's
getting rid of the dead zones.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things we didn't mention that is really important to success as a garden of a garden is to test your soil and see what kind of soil do you have, and if it's missing something, especially if you're, you know, if you're talking about soil around your home, because when houses are built, there's a lot of toxins that go into the ground, and a lot of the soil can die from that. And sometimes your success as a gardener, you might be doing everything right, but there is something that needs to be added to the soil. Mm-hmm. So that's one other tip I would say, is just get your soil tested in different parts of your land that you have.
And get kids involved, because it's really cool. It's a fun way to get them to understand nature and science, and get them unplugged from the screen and get their hands dirty. And everybody needs to get their hands dirty, even if it's in poop. I'm just saying.
Okay.
And they love it. Like last year when I brought the worm bin in, and for the, because I had like this little garden club we ran with the second and third graders last year, and we had a greenhouse, and for one of our last days I brought the worm bin back in a giant tub that they could see. Like, and even when the worms were in my classroom, I had the hardest time keeping the kids out of it. Like I'd be like, you can't get in there now, you can do it during your lunch break, or you know, some other time. You can't be in the worm bin during reading. They loved it, and they love, like I was saying, they love to eat the vegetables. Like they're still asking me, like, when's Mr. Buyer gonna have those purple dragon tongue green beans again? And just they it's hands-on. And like one day we did this project, and I was asking my kids, what was your favorite part of the project? And they were like, just doing it. They didn't care about the outcome. They didn't care about the science of it or any of that part. They were just like, so they didn't care. Like they want to take it home and show their parents. They were just like, the whole fun was just in getting to do something besides sit there with a worksheet and a paper and a teacher lecturing them at the board. And yeah, you're so right. Kids love it. And there, I have to say, there is an awesome farm to school movement going on, you know, gardens, school gardens going on, but I think my listeners will like that encouragement to get involved in their school. Because I do have a lot of listeners that are pretty experienced gardens. And so I've been kind of thinking that's kind of a nice challenge for them to start reaching out and teaching more. And the other thing that, like, a lot of people on my show, like, kind of like, I wasn't interested in gardening at all when I was a kid. So if you have kids and they're resisting, I just always like to encourage people, just, you know, take it with a grain of salt. They're probably absorbing more than you think. And someday they're going to share that with their kids. Like, just, you know, try to keep it low pressure and keep doing it. Yeah. And sharing your enthusiasm.
There's nothing like the practical experience, just like you said, about history comes to life when you're in those places. And, you know, you feel the history when you're in a place versus here's your book, you remember this date. Getting out and, you know, everybody's into selfies and Instagram. So when you go out to a park, photograph a plant or photograph a bug, and then look up the relationship between those two things, and it will become very clear to you why it is so important to have native plants. Because, like, there's a butterfly in and the Borrego Desert, and if they don't have this one yucca plant to feed off of and have for shelter, that entire butterfly species will go away, which means this one type of bird species will not get food. So that is something to really understand. The power of native plants is to go out, take a photograph of a plant you don't know, do some research on it, and can guarantee you that plant in its natural habitat is food for something so specific. And we don't even think about it when we, you know, tear things down or, you know, just replace another plant with one plant that doesn't belong there. So just have a look at that, because every time you plant something, make it be something that counts for food or shelter or a place for young to be raised.
Nice. Do you have anything to talk about Standing Rock by any chance? I mean, I can totally edit this out if you don't, but something maybe.
Sure. Like, sure. We did some interviews on Standing Rock. Uh-huh. Absolutely. You know, we actually did, it was, Labor Day weekend. And Labor Day, we ended up doing a show with Cody Hall, who was with the Red Warrior Camp. And he called in. It was right after they released these dogs. These mercenaries released the dogs on the people that had found, you know, the ancestral remains. And there's these burial sites. And, you know, this, you shouldn't be touching this land. It was in that easement area. And they released these dogs and brought the bulldozers out. And so their camp and, of course, so many more were, you know, tied to the bulldozers, and especially women really came to the forefront on that. And so we interviewed him for about an hour on our show, live show. And he was talking about the oil being like this big black snake, and, you know, that comes in, and understanding again the attachment to water. Just because these pipelines are going under the water doesn't mean it affects the water or the ground. So yeah, that we've done a lot of follow up on that. We've done interviews with the Sierra Club, Global Green USA. We've done a lot on it, actually.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to put the links to that interview in the show notes, and I'm definitely going to have to check it out. And I'm even going to show it to my kids.
I'll send it to you. Absolutely.
Because, yeah. It's so important. And we watch a lot of Democracy Now, Amy Goodman. And sure. I think that's when she got arrested, was when
she got
the dogs got attacked
day.
For reporting on that
Cody
issue.
Yeah, took her out there. Yeah, he took her out there, and she at least they threw that out the court finally. Look how long it took, and so many mm-hmm. people are still going through it. I would definitely, I can't remember their name right now off the top of my head. It's a Lakota. Oh, Winona.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know how you played that song after mine? I think I might play a song after yours, because we took a class from a woman, and she gave us that, is it Water? I can't believe I can't think of it, but I'll put that in the show notes for sure. I might even play some of it at the end. That's a beautiful song. We sang that with my kids, and they just love to sing it from that day. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Winona LaDuke. Wait, no.
That's it. Yeah, she's awesome. She's incredible. Yeah.
But this song is like Wenichi something. Mm-hmm. I can't think of this song. So, well, I think this is an awesome place to end. I can't thank you enough. I know you guys are busy and you have your deadline with your magazine. Now, your garden show is it Garden Gossip, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. because we want to look at what's going on in the neighbors.
That's right.
But it's Garden Gossip is a home and garden show. We do both, because whatever is outside should be organic, and so is inside too. It's all related.
Okay. Well, do you want to just tell listeners how to connect with you, like all your different webs? Because you have several websites, and then about the magazine again, just one more time. Like, how do they subscribe to it? Is it a digital, or there's a paper version, or I forgot?
Yeah, it's completely digital. And we have two magazines. We have Big Blend Radio and TV Magazine. It's a variety publication. And it covers everything from home and garden to food and wine, travel, history, nature, family, the arts, music and the arts. And you can go to, and business, you can go to blendradioandtv.com. So blend like in blender. And our Big Blend Radio shows are all on that website, all our social media. The other is to keep up with our national park travels, and not just in this country, but around the world. It's Parks and Travel Magazine, also digital. They both come out every 2 months. They're completely free. And for that, you can go to nationalparktraveling.com, and all the content's on the website as well. And you can listen to interviews, watch videos as well. So we do a lot of videos too. But thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today. We talked about so much, but I think mostly we talked about what is the key to helping preserve our planet. And I just love that you are such stewards and educational stewards, teaching people how to live a greener life. So God bless you both. And thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you. You take care and have fun in your garden, and stay away from the blizzard, though.
Yeah.
It's all good. I'm home safe today. So, and actually, I had a great week. Thank you so much for everything. And let me know when you come to Montana.
Oh, we will do, for sure. Thanks. You take care and have a good next interview.
Okay. Thanks, Lisa. Thanks, Nancy. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Every nation come, all my relations under the sun. We are one. We are praying come. We are praying come. song and we are the drum. We are one. We are the river come. We are the river come. We are the boat, the paddle, the shore. We are one. Miniwichoni sing. Miniwichoni sing. Miniwichoni water is life for everything. We are the water sing. We are the water sing. We are the water. We are where all the life begins. We are the ancient ones. We are the ancient ones. In your breath and bones we sing on. We are one. We are the meadow. We are the meadow come. We are the lark that sings. The new day has begun. We are the new day. Run, run, run. We are the new day. Run, run, run. We are the old and we are the young. We are. Miniwichoni sing, Takuyeoyas. Miniwichoni sing, Takuyeoyas. Miniwichoni water is a life for everything. We are the water sing, Takuyeoyas. We are the water sing, Takuyeoyas. We are the water. We are. We are the earth and sky. We are the thunder cries. We are the fire. We are the light in your eyes. We are standing strong, like a rock, like a stone, on the sacred ground. Come, all my relations under.